Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our two-part series on this country's homeless crisis. Yesterday, we discussed the root causes of homelessness in California, what is working, and what needs to change. Today, we will broaden that discussion. In January 2020, over 580,000 people were homeless in the U.S. This is according to official numbers from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Advocates say that number is likely much higher. 70% were individuals. The rest were families with children. Homelessness among older adults is rapidly increasing. Approximately half of single homeless adults over the age of 50, according to several reports, including Generations, American Society on Aging. Of these, almost half first became homeless after age 50. Adults ages 50 and older who are homeless are experiencing health conditions, including cognitive and functional impairment, 20 years earlier than their housed counterparts. And advocates are really warning the alarm bells about this because they say that if we do not make much needed changes in this country, this issue especially is just going to get worse. Now, we've done so many shows about this crisis over the years. Today, we will revisit how we got here. We'll also discuss solutions and what needs to change. Today, we're joined by two guests. Chris Herring is assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's Inequality in America Initiative. Chris Herring's research focuses on poverty, housing, and homelessness in U.S. cities. His forthcoming book, Cruel Streets, explores how San Francisco intensified punishment toward the unhoused amidst initiatives of criminal justice reform and shelter expansion. Last April, Chris Herring published an article in the Annals of the Academy of Political and Social Sciences called Complaint-Oriented Services, Shelters as Tools for Criminalizing Homelessness. Chris Herring recently tweeted about a sweep he witnessed in San Francisco. A camp of 27 people were shuffled around the corner. They were offered beds in shelters with active COVID outbreaks. One woman was a cancer patient who would qualify for a FEMA-funded hotel. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Paul Bowden, Organizing Director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, a nonprofit that works to expose and eliminate the root causes of homelessness and poverty, empower communities to demand protection of civil and human rights, and advocate for restoring federal funding for affordable housing. In 2007, Paul and his team published a report called Without Housing: Decades of Federal Housing Cutbacks, Massive Homelessness, and Policy Failures. Paul Bowden became homeless at the age of 16 after the death of his mother. He began volunteering at a drop-in shelter in San Francisco in 1983 and eventually became the shelter's program director. Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me. And hey, Chris.
You know, Paul, I was just looking back at some of the shows that you've been on with us. I mean, so many over the years.
There's quite a few.
Quite a few. And I feel like I just ask you the same questions over and over again. I mean, Paul, when you look back, let's say just 5 years, what's really changed? Has anything gotten better?
A lot's changed and none of it's gotten better. And I fear that we're seeing with all of this process stuff and committees and task forces and coordinating boards and regional plans and local plans and five-year plans and 10-year plans and chronic homeless plans, we're putting our head further and further into the sand and getting away from the simplicity of the issue of cause and effect. In the 1980s, we wiped out affordable housing funding and tripled our homeowner housing subsidies through the mortgage interest deduction program because we were implementing the Reagan revolution of neoliberalism in America. And this problem has gotten worse and worse and worse ever since. And the blaming the person and research, are they left-handed? Are they right-handed? Are they disabled? substance abuse, mental illness, poverty, racism, these things all existed before 1983. And as a society, we need to address these issues. If we want to address homelessness, we need to be talking about reinvesting and making sure people have a home. It's that simple.
You know, Paul, we'll go over this during the show, but just a couple statistics when you look at what has really changed. You all point out that when the federal government began dismantling housing, treatment, welfare, and employment programs in the late 70s and 80s, it basically created contemporary mass homelessness. And you point out that in 1978, HUD's budget was over $83 billion. And then just 5 years later in 1983, HUD's budget was $18 billion. So it went from $83 to $18 billion. What is it today?
And that's in 2004 constant dollars, because we have to make sure people understand that. But today is about $37 billion.
Okay, so these $83 billion was in 2004 constant dollars?
Yes.
Okay, and so today it's $37 billion?
Not in constant dollars, but it's around $37 billion right now.
Okay.
And that's for all of HUD's programs. That's the HUD funding that the federal government has passed.
Okay.
So that's for everything that HUD does.
Chris, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, Paul has personal experience with homelessness and has worked on this issue for decades. And he's saying that the issue has just gotten worse over the last 5 years. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to agree with Paul in the big picture. You know, there have been some improvements in the ways in which we're making positive improvements around the edges on this. But for every, you know, new initiative we have around permanent supportive housing or moving people off the streets because we haven't addressed the root issues of housing, with mass incarceration, of these other structural issues, we have more and more folks unable to afford housing who are just one paycheck away from not being able to afford rent. And this is leading to more people becoming homelessness or at the risk of becoming homelessness than we had even 20 years ago.
You know, Chris, one of the statistics that really has stuck with me since yesterday's show is that, and this is the case in many, many cities, definitely in San Francisco, for every person who is housed, three more people fall into homelessness. I mean, that's just incredible to think about.
Yeah, yeah, it's a really ongoing treadmill here. And I think that's important to keep in mind. The dynamic nature of homelessness is something we often forget. The way in which we do these point in time counts, which is the number you referred to at the beginning of the show, right? The 580,000, that was on a single night. But during the year, people are falling into and out of homelessness. Another number that I think is useful to draw to is the number used by our Department of Education, which asks children in school, have they experienced homelessness in the year? And those numbers are consistently much higher. In 2020 school year, there were over 1,200,000 children who reported being homeless at some time during the year. And that gives you a much more accurate vision of how many people are impacted by homelessness.
Well, and that's where I bring up the thing about the studies and the research, which, you know, when the federal government wants to ignore an issue, they form a task force. And, you know, in 1937, when what is today called HUD, it was the Public Housing Act of 1937, the mandate for this new federal agency was to remedy the unsafe and unsanitary housing conditions and acute shortage of decent, safe and sanitary dwellings for for families of lower incomes. In 1998, when we did welfare reform under Clinton with Gingrich at the lead, they changed that mandate to say the federal government cannot, through its direct action alone, provide housing of every American or even the majority of its citizens. So forget the racist citizens, American stuff. The whole, this was 16 years after the advent of contemporary homelessness. They changed the mandate of the Federal Housing Agency to say it cannot be held accountable to ensure that even a majority of its people have housing. Yet with the homeowner tax program, everybody who's eligible gets it. There's no waiting list. There's no intake. It's $127 billion in housing subsidies to homeowners. But the $37 billion in housing subsidies for poor people, we say we can't afford. And we screen them and we do intakes. And there's 20-year waiting lists. It's just classism run amok.
Right. You know, Paul, when we started, you said that we really need to focus on the simplicity of the issue of cause and effect. We don't need to look at these in-depth reports. Just let's talk about this in a simple way. So how do you think this issue needs to be discussed? What's missing from the conversations you're hearing?
And of course, I say that as somebody that put out a report, right?
So, right. Well, your report's chock full of really great information, and it's got a lot of history in it.
I mean, I'm not saying that I don't think racism and classism are vital issues, or that healthcare shouldn't be a human right, or that we need to get the criminal justice system, as we call it, out of mental illness and substance abuse. I mean, we've so policed houselessness, mental illness, and substance abuse that our court systems have set up separate systems within the courts to address substance abuse, mental illness, and homelessness. There's homeless courts, substance abuse courts, and mental health courts. That doesn't tell us that systemically our approach is a punitive, oppressive approach using the police and private security apparatuses. Nothing else possibly could. So I'm not saying that stuff's not real and that we don't need to be dealing with it as a society. And I feel we should have been dealing with that stuff before 1983. I'm saying don't convolute the issue of creating housing for people, just people, not chronic, not left-handed, not right-handed, for people. Don't convolute that issue with the other social issues that we need to address as a society. You want to deal, nothing ends homelessness like a home. So focus all of your energy. 40 years we've been doing this now, since, or 39 years since San Francisco opened its homeless programs. And when this Without Housing report came out in 2006, you know, Gavin Newsom said to me straight up, well, we were saying you should be working with us to fight at the federal level to restore the housing that was eliminated. And he said, well, I need their money to fund my homeless program, so I'm not going to do it.
Paul, can you tell us, in terms of public housing, in the report, you note that from 1976 to 82, HUD built over 755,000 new public housing units. Since 83, HUD has built 256,000. Is that still the correct number?
I'm sorry, which HUD dismantled, not built?
Well, in your report, you write that since 83, HUD built 256,000, but between 76 and 82, HUD built 755,000.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just a matter of how many units were able to be generated with the funding that was being allocated. So HUD was allocating funding that allowed local governments and local communities to develop those numbers of units. But, you know, you got to also remember between 95 and 2011, HUD dismantled 290,000 units of public housing, and this is all Hope 6 stuff, and 360,000 units of Section 8. So it's just like for every one that gets into housing, three people are falling out into the street. You know, like the bottom line is, you know, when we had funding at a level pre-1980, we didn't have general public emergency shelter programs. We didn't have youth shelter programs. We didn't have family shelter programs. Some of the housing was funky, whatever. We needed to fix a lot of the stuff up. But people had an alternative to setting up tents and setting up sleeping bags and sleeping in the streets. And when they had that alternative, they took advantage of it. This whole service resistant argument, or before that it was they're all from somewhere else, and before that it was we're all there by choice, like, that's just putting your head further and further into the sand, and it's obfuscating the responsibility of a simple analysis of what created this situation so we can target our resources to address it.
So, Paul, how do you think the conversation around housing should sound? I mean, what should that look like? Because we just hear that we have a need for affordable housing, and we always say, well, what does affordable even mean these days?
Well, no kidding. That's because of they want to do shallow housing subsidies, because low-income housing tax credit and now RAD, the Resident Assistance Demonstration Program, are trying to incentivize profits for investors to invest in developing affordable housing, which just is asinine at its base. You know, to take a public responsibility and say, well, if we can make it, well, it's neoliberalism is what it is. If we can make it so that others make a profit off of this investment, then it's a good investment for the federal government to put money into. Of course, that means that the housing isn't affordable to the poorest of the poor. And you start getting into all these machinations about 60% of median income, 80%, 120%, you know, and the people that are poor are at 20% or 15% of median income. So you're calling it affordable housing, but it's not affordable to the people that need it the most.
Right. Chris, what would you add? What are your thoughts about the conversations you're hearing around the need, the desperate need for more housing, and what affordable actually means today?
Yeah, I agree completely that at root is housing conditions. And a recent book by Professor University of Washington, Greg Colburn and Clayton Aldern, called Homelessness is a Housing Problem, makes one of the clearest arguments on this, where they show that housing market conditions, mainly cost and availability of rental housing, are the best predictors of rates of homelessness on a per capita basis in cities. And it shows that, you know, places like Seattle, where they're based, which have less poverty and less mental illness, less addiction than a lot of many regions, but the consequences of those conditions are much worse than places like Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and other places that have much lower rents. You know, when you asked about how homelessness has been changing across the nation, it's actually overall gone down slightly since 2007 by 10% totally. Family is much larger, actually down by 27%. And much of the U.S. has seen, you know, double-digit drops. But it has increased by double digits in four places: New York, California, Massachusetts, and D.C. And all these places have extremely expensive housing. And so, you know, when I also agree with Paul that the country has really left in the long scope of history behind housing. And the types of conversations that we were hearing in the last presidential election were really encouraging to me, even though they've not materialized, not even in this Build Back America Act. But, you know, discussions by the Sanders, Warren, and Castro campaign of building 12 million units of social green housing in the next decade, fully funding the Section 8 vouchers, of which only about a quarter of Americans who are eligible currently have access to. It's these sorts of, you know, broad-based federal policies that are going to really be able to pull the country out of homelessness if the political will is there.
There have been some articles about where housing first policies are working. The Howard Center for Investigative Journalism looked at Houston and San Diego. They had housing first approaches, but they had very different results. Housing revamped its system to get more people. I'm sorry, Houston revamped its system to get more people into housing and cut homelessness by more than half, while San Diego attempted a series of one-off projects and saw far fewer reductions in homelessness. So, Chris, based on the research you've done, can you point to any places where they're getting it right, and what are they doing?
Yeah, that's a great point about Houston. And the places that do have, you know, longer term serious commitments to permanent supportive housing do show more sustained results. But the other big difference between a place like Houston and San Diego goes back to, of course, housing costs. And what we see is these places which have much higher vacancy levels, much lower rental costs, Everyone was talking about Salt Lake City and Utah in 2010 to 2015. They were able to do this. Houston is able to do this. It's much easier to be able to make vouchers work and get people into housing in places like this. And so we hit a wall at some point. Even in San Francisco, which has more permanent supportive housing per capita than any city, the big gains came under the Newsom years. Although it's also important to mention that he decimated the general assistance, of which poor people in the city were getting at that time, in order to fund the housing. But we saw a large expansion of permanent supportive housing, taking advantage of the large number of single room occupancy hotels. And once those low hanging fruits were taken up, it's become much harder to acquire new property. So it really goes to the point that we need to continue to build. A similar thing was shown with vouchers that can go a very far way. Something we should want to highlight is the ability that we've had to end veteran homelessness in many parts of the country, where veteran homelessness has decreased in half over the last 5 years. And this has been done through vouchers. However, now it's gotten to the point where we have 14,000 vouchers unused, because in certain areas with high rents, it becomes increasingly difficult to use those. And among Section 8 vouchers as well, even 30% of people who get the vouchers are unable to utilize them, which points to the need of really building out more housing.
Okay, so the need to build more housing, you make a great point about Houston and San Diego in terms of the costs. And I think about like Sonoma County, where I grew up, more homeless people in tents along the river, more people in shopping centers asking for money. And yet I am just shocked at how much housing's going up. New apartment buildings, so much housing in Rohnert Park. And yet and in Petaluma, yet the prices are so high. I grew up there. I never thought I would see 800, 900,000, $1 million price tags on homes in places like Petaluma and Rohnert Park. But that is what I'm seeing right now. So how do you tackle that, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, not all housing is, useful in reducing homelessness. And it also depends on the location. But you're right, they're very tiered housing markets. And as Paul was speaking to, the focus on affordability is key. And so when we talk about affordable housing, yeah, it is important to talk about affordable housing for who. There are in places like San Francisco now, which is so saturated with an intensifying wealth, there is a role where, you know, if you're building within certain sectors of more middle income or upper income housing, that will absorb people, in which might move into other areas and displace folks in the areas out in Santa Rosa you're talking about. Sounds like just, you know, wealthy people moving in. Right. But what we have seen, especially when financial crises hit, like in 2008, was that a lot of the housing that was being made for people with 30% or below the area of medium income, those brackets were raised. And those will do nothing to provide getting people off the streets. Whereas it may allow people to stay in housing a bit longer, that's not going to add to the stock that's going to be reachable among the most vulnerable.
Before we go to break, Paul, we've just got an email from Steve in Seattle who says, as a region, we have the resources to end homelessness. Please ask your guests how society should determine who has a right to live where. Until this basic mindset issue is addressed and there's some consensus, we'll never have enough housing. Paul, what are your thoughts? Paul, are you still with us?
Yeah, sorry. Chris had me on mute. Sorry.
Oh, okay. That's all right.
So, I mean, the question was, who has the right to live where? Like, that's the question we need to answer in order to address homelessness.
Well, this listener says, how society should determine who has a right to live where, until this mindset issue is addressed, we won't have enough housing.
I don't totally follow that, but I think that anybody that's living or standing still or sitting down or sleeping in a non-obstructive manner has the right to be in public space, regardless of their housing status. So if they're not bothering anybody and they're not bugging people and they're not in the way, so to speak, you know, leave them the hell alone. Like, don't arrest people just because they're sleeping or sitting on a sidewalk. That makes no sense to me. But I think that, you know, we talk about the developers are building housing all over the place. Well, they got a tax program called the capital gains taxes and stuff that when they invest their profits to make more money by building more housing, they get a tax write-off for that. So we have this mindset of gearing our economic system and gearing our federal investments, because money not collected through taxes is the same as money given out. It's this: if you owe me $50 and I tell you to keep it, I just gave you $50. So we have this mindset that so long as it's generating a profit, then it's a worthy investment of our government. I think that's the mindset that needs to change. Not everything has to be a commodity in order for it to be a public benefit. Education, treatment, housing, not all of that stuff needs to be commodified in order for it to be a worthwhile investment of our federal government.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are continuing our series on the homeless crisis, and we will continue to do these shows throughout the year. Paul Bowden is organizing director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, a nonprofit working to expose and eliminate the root causes of homelessness and poverty. Chris Herring is assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's Inequality in America Initiative. We will talk about Chris Herring's forthcoming book, Cruel Streets, which explores how San Francisco intensified punishment towards the unhoused amidst initiatives of criminal justice reform and shelter expansion, after a quick break. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow on our media roundtable, we will discuss a Reveal investigation about the 2014 disappearance of 43 students in Mexico. Reveal exposes corruption at the highest levels of government and connects the story to the U.S. war on drugs. We will also discuss coverage of Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema killing the Democrats' voting rights legislation, along with all of the Republicans. And we'll talk about the big money behind voter suppression. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show about the homeless crisis, we got so many emails yesterday that we couldn't get to, so I will read some of those today. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call 866-798-8255. If you have a personal story to share, we would love to hear from you. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio. Chris Herring is assistant professor of sociology at UCLA and is the author of a forthcoming book, Cruel Streets, looking at San Francisco's intensified punishment toward the unhoused. Paul Bowden is organizing director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. They expose and work to eliminate the root causes of homelessness. Paul became homeless at the age of 16 after the death of his mom. He began volunteering at a drop-in shelter in San Francisco in 1983 and eventually became the shelter's program director. Before we talk about your book, Chris, I just wanted to mention we were inundated with emails yesterday from so many people from, you know, different backgrounds just talking about their stories. Julie writes, "I'm from the Bay Area. I live in North Carolina. I've been here since 2007 and have low rent. I am now disabled. I can afford to live here on disability with a part-time job, but I could never afford to move back to the Bay Area at this point." So many things have pushed people out of the Bay Area. And then we have another email from a listener who says, "I own my own home, but even with that buffer of ownership versus a rental, a health crisis can still put one at risk of becoming homeless. So I am particularly sensitive to that possibility." Chris, we just got email after email from people with personal stories, from people who could not afford to live here anymore, to people who own their own homes but feel like they're still living on the edge.
Yeah, it's utterly frightening. You know, even though I mentioned that some of the overall homeless numbers have gone down over the last 10 years, we're seeing it in new and different ways and in ways in which we can't easily count. So, you know, rural homelessness, for instance, even though it's not as much as in urban areas, it's growing and it's also very difficult to count. There's way more unsheltered homelessness out there. Those doubled up. Now, it's estimated that in 2019, 3.7 million people were doubled up. That means living with a family member or living somewhere where it's not your home, which was higher than 2007. And those paying more than 50% on their incomes of rent has gone up drastically. So those experiences aren't surprising to me at all, unfortunately, and shows how much, you know, just the fear of homelessness permeates people experiencing poverty in general.
Exactly. And Paul, I mean, the issue of elder homelessness is getting more attention, but so many advocates say if we don't take action in this country, I mean, the least we can do is lift Social Security payments. To think that a lot of people are living off of $800, $900, $1,000 a month, which is impossible in a state like California. They say this issue is about to, I mean, it's already exploding, but it's about to get worse with, you know, people over the age of 50 who are living on the streets.
Well, and that's where it gets so frustrating that we continue to just identify these issues, talk about these issues, hear from people talking about these issues and from their own experiences. And then we go back and talk about housing vouchers. Mm. Housing vouchers were created when through Hope 6, when they were destroying hundreds of thousands of units of public housing. And saying, well, go in the open market. The open market will take care of you. It's like we've gone to the altar of trickle down economics, and we're wondering why poor people are now marginally poor people, or whatever little categories we've created now of food insecure as opposed to hungry. Like we keep creating new layers of and priorities of who we should be paying attention to. And in fact, paying attention to none of it, like just get to the root cause. Housing is really cool. Housing is awesome. Housing is something that benefits the whole community when all of us have it. So damn it, like government, you're supposed to be serving us as our government. And if housing is a really vital, important tool in our society, make sure that everybody has an opportunity to have a decent place to live. If education is an important tool in our society, make sure that everybody, not just the wealthy, have access to a kick-ass education system. Like, why isn't that a role and a priority of our government? Like, how come we can do these hundreds of billions of dollars for a military-industrial complex that mainly benefits corporations and not feel that it is a responsibility of our government to be ensuring that healthcare treatment, education, things that benefit the whole society are a priority of our spending patterns?
Well, it's a great point, yeah, Paul. Just quickly, Chris, because this didn't get that much attention unless you were really paying attention because it happened over Christmas and the holidays. President Biden signed a $770 billion military bill at the end of the year. So that just speaks to what you're talking about, Paul.
Yeah. And there was no debate. There was nobody got, you know, oh, but are they worthy of that money? No, it just happens. When the government wants it to happen, it can happen. You know, Representative Omar introduced an awesome piece of legislation that was called Homes for All. And you could barely get the Democrats to support it, much less the Republicans. That's how ingrained trickle-down economics has become. Mm-hmm. So the Democrats want to do housing vouchers for all. And Ilhan Omar was talking about making sure that there's housing for people, not just giving people vouchers and sending them into the public market. You know, if the feds don't want to house us, what makes them think that the private industry wants to house us? The private landlords want to deal with HUD's bureaucracy to collect their rent. The private landlords aren't racist. You think those vouchers are equal for everybody that goes out with one? Maybe if you're a vet and you're white, you might be able to find a landlord that will deal with that crap in order for you to have a place to live. But trust me, if you're poor and you're a family and you're black, you're going to have a much harder time playing the open market with a voucher program. Mm.
Chris, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, just on the comment of the aging and elderly. I mean, during my research in San Francisco, I spent a number of days and nights in the shelters and following people in and out of housing. And one thing I don't think folks recognize that is in San Francisco, if you're getting the Social Security disability, right, you're getting between like $900 to $1,100 a month. Well, to get even a rental of a single room occupancy hotel for a month in, you know, the Tenderloin, those are costing $900 to $1,000 a month. Whereas, you know, in the early 2000s, they were just, you know, $200, $300 a month. And so now you get your check. It would all go to rent if you did that. You're not able to get food stamps because you're getting this disability income. So a lot of the long food lines we see in San Francisco are of elderly folks who are spending all their money to just stay inside. If you want to be in a shelter, because you're taking the benefit again, you're not allowed a guaranteed shelter bed. So you have to go in for 90 days and then you're out on the streets or in a hotel for a month, et cetera. And it's just this way that I think we need to highlight that's especially hard for older people on fixed incomes and in these expensive cities. Many people trying to stay close to family or where they've lived their entire lives or with their medical services there. And it's incredibly hard to make a life on that sort of income.
We're going to get to calls. We've got a lot of callers on the line, but I just wanted to ask you, Chris, add to that the sweeps. You've witnessed the sweeps, Paul. Chris, just tell us about the recent one that you witnessed and what you heard from people.
Well, it was a bit of a fly-in for me. I was only in town for a week, and I went out on outreach with a member from the Coalition on Homelessness. You know, we're still in the Omicron spike. I've been reading a lot about the Tenderloin Emergency Ordinance, in which the mayor is talking a big game about increasing both the police pressure and sanitation operations down there. And we got there at the conclusion of a sweep. The sanitation vehicles were moving out on an alley in south of Market, and the street was totally cleared. And then on every alley alongside this main alley were individuals. No one took a shelter bed that was offered. The shelter that they were told that was on offer was one that was in the news just a week before with a Omicron outbreak. Right now in LA, I believe more than half of the shelters have cases of Omicron in there. They're just being offered congregate shelter and no other option, even as they were at the beginning of this, where they were being offered hotel rooms that are fully reimbursed by FEMA and still are. Everyone was just one block away. People were told that the police would be coming back tomorrow, but that in 2 or 3 days, they were told by the sanitation crews that they may be able to move back to their original spots. So not much has changed since I was doing my research pre-pandemic in how these sweeps would play out, which I'd be happy to talk about. But it's especially perverse when we have fully funded FEMA rooms available on offer by the federal government and at the peak of another surge. Hmm.
Paul, before we get to calls, you know how ugly the conversation can get in San Francisco. You know, a lot of people are tired of this crisis, especially in a wealthy city like San Francisco. What are your thoughts about how we can talk about it? I mean, you need an hour, obviously. You can't do it in a soundbite, but how to really talk about the root causes so we can get past a lot of the ugly things that we see, especially on social media.
I mean, I think we have to stop pathologizing homeless people in order for us to get to that point. I mean, we've been hearing for 39 years now, we're from somewhere else, we're dangerous, we're mentally ill, we're drug addicted, we're everything but human beings. And that just and we saw the same thing with welfare reform, and all of the people on welfare were cheats and bums and drug addicts and using it for crack cocaine. And I mean, we do this pathologizing people that we systemically as a government are choosing to screw over. We have to make, we have to other those human beings. And at the local level and at the federal level, we've done it consistently with people that are unhoused in our community. And so we have to break that stigma by talking about universally. I mean, I was on a call yesterday with the mayor and two city council members in Talent, Oregon, which is a community of 6,500 people, having the same kind of discussion where they're inundated with people that are unhoused in their community, and the hatred and the calls for policing of their existence are just off the hooks. And the city council members are like, we need to try to change this discussion. And that's the kind of thing where I feel like, you know, we saw it in the 30s where rap uses this poster that the mayor of New York put out in 1936 saying, must we always have this, with images of homelessness? Why not housing? And it was 1937 when the federal government passed the Public Housing Administration Act. So we can join forces and we can be powerful when there's a consistent message of humanity coming from our local community members, our organizations, and our government. But so long as beating up on homeless people is a political ploy to go from being a board of supervisor member to the mayor to now the governor, you know, unfortunately, it's an uphill battle.
Paul Bowden is organizing director of RAP, Western Regional Advocacy Project. Chris Herring is assistant professor of sociology at UCLA. Thank you, everyone, for waiting so patiently. Let's try to go through as many callers as possible. Let's hear from Ed in San Francisco. Hi, Ed. Ed?
Oh, hello?
Oh, hi. Go ahead, Ed. Thanks for holding.
I tried to get into a HUD in San Mateo. I just turned 65, and I was working part-time as an Uber driver. And they refused to, what happened is, what I was making as an Uber driver, according to them, included the money that I spent on maintenance and gasoline. They considered that my income. So I couldn't afford to go into the HUD housing because they were charging me as much as I would be charged in a regular apartment.
So what did you do, Ed?
Oh, well, I went back and moved into the place I was there. I was 65, and I was hoping to cut down my income. So I went back and moved in with a friend as a roommate, but I was still, you know, I was spending the same amount of money as I would have been spending at HUD.
Wow.
And actually, I was lucky because when COVID came in, I think that it was a senior housing, and I probably would have gotten COVID.
You know, thank you for calling, Ed. We got an email yesterday from someone who had a similar situation with CAPS. And I really want to bring on some politicians to say, you know, what is it going to take to change these financial caps? Because people who are not making much money cannot get services. And it seems like, what will it take to change that? So thank you so much for calling in, Ed, and sharing your story. We will definitely do a show about that soon. Paul, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, because I bet that was a low-income housing tax credit housing unit. And people don't understand the differentials. But when you say that we're going to use money that comes from investors, so therefore the investors have to make a profit on what they invest, your rents have to be higher. Like when we did the mortgaging of housing units in public housing, people are now having to use housing vouchers to get into a public housing unit. That's just asinine. Mm. Those units were originally created to serve the poorest of the poor, and now we're using another HUD program of housing vouchers in order for people to be able to afford to live in those units. They call them shallow subsidies, and all it means is the income levels of the people that can afford to live in affordable housing has to be higher than what a poor person gets.
Well, thank you for the call, Ed. Let's go next to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Hi, do we have Mary?
This is, hello?
Hi, Mary?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay,
Can you hear me now?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay, good. And at first I was homeless for a year. I just turned 71, and I was homeless for a year in my 60s, and I concur with your guests. We cannot voucher our way out of this, and Social Security benefits really need to play a part in this, because the very populations you're talking about, half of single homeless people are over the age of 50, when we speak of veterans and disabled, these are all communities receiving benefits through Social Security. And I'd like to encourage people to get in touch with people on the Budget Committee, our Senator Alex Padilla, the Chair Bernie Sanders, and say, look, these Social Security benefits need to be recalibrated. It's not enough for a simplistic raise the cap fix. We need to go back and recalibrate, going back to the 60s and 70s, and bring them up to present day. Because what concerns me about the Build Back Better and all of the let's raise the minimum wage is that it creates this kind of imbalance, and now we have inflation. Perhaps there should be a moratorium on minimum wage raising until Social Security is recalibrated. And they need to do some math. Okay, we've got people on the Budget Committee who don't do math. So thank you for
this
topic.
Thank you so much, Mary. And we're definitely going to do a Social Security show soon because this definitely needs so much more attention. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Iris in San Francisco. Hi, Iris. Welcome to the show. Do we have Iris?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good. Hi, Rose. Okay. I just had an idea that if the government could do something like foster care for adults, where people could take homeless people into their homes, get some financial support, and then they could be protected that way.
You know, I was actually reading about a program like that for youth and LGBTQ youth. And I definitely want to add that to our show ideas. So thank you so much for that call.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. One more caller. Let's go to Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia.
Advisor at Berkeley Adult School, and my job is to help people find services, including homes for the homeless students that we have. And in the 5 years I've been working there, I could count on the fingers of one hand the people I've actually been able to find housing for. And I keep thinking that it's my fault, that I somehow haven't clicked into, you know, what the best way of, you know, accessing those services are, because there must be help out there, right? But after listening to Paul, I just couldn't agree with him more. It's a mess, and it's all comes down, in my opinion, to greed. As long as the rich are controlling Washington, I don't see how the situation is going to change. But my question to him is, what can I do? What am I not seeing? I refer people to lotteries, you know, with Zaha and groups like that. I, you know, send them to, you know, the different entry points. Most people don't want to live in a shelter for obvious reasons, but even that is difficult to arrange now, and I'm befuddled.
Alicia, we missed the first part of your call. Are you helping students?
Yes, I'm helping adult students who are homeless.
Okay, thank you so much for the call. Paul, any advice for Alicia?
Yeah, we got to join forces and we got to fight. Like, you know, it's not going to just change out of compassion or by the politicians waking up tomorrow and realizing, oh, wow, for 40 years, we've been screwing these people over. You know, we put out the word because a lot of communities are really, like, when you're getting swept and constantly swept, whether it's rural or urban, it doesn't matter. You know, it's a really frustrating and you're getting your butts kicked feeling. And, you know, one thing with the RAP member groups and the organizations that have joined our Stop the Sweeps campaign, you know, is when we all join forces, at least we have each other. And we can understand the plight that each other is going through. And then we can fight for things like the Homes for All Act, which is actually addressing the root causes of the creation of contemporary homelessness. You know, we can fight for a living wage. You know, we don't get much money. Trust me, this is not a United Way funded organization. you know, but we were trying to look at how to do, you know, some cost of living adjustments for the people that work here. And we thought, wow, we can do 3%. And the cost of living went up 7%.
Wow.
So like we're in this constant cycle of trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. And if we all pool our 15 cents together, then maybe we can come up with a buck.
Hmm. Chris, what would you add? We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, I would just have to echo Paul that the solution has got to be building political power, organizing across communities to change this at the political level. It's going to require a political solution, and that's only going to be done through that collective organizing.
It's so hard because when you were talking about that, I was thinking at the federal level, we can't even get voting rights legislation passed without Sinema and Manchin changing the filibuster rules.
Yeah, but don't forget Hope 6 was, and welfare reform was the Democrats. So I don't know that it really should be just a matter of, oh, well, we have an opportunity now because there's a Democrat in office. It's we have to band together. We have to, and, you know, we do get our butts kicked a lot, but our parties are awesome. So by banding together and just, you know, understanding this is a long haul campaign. It's not one politician's going to come and save us. It's that we're going to join forces and save ourselves.
Mm. Well, yeah, Paul, thank you for that. I think we all needed to hear that, especially on a day after the voting rights legislation went down. Paul Bowden is organizing director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. They work to expose and eliminate the root causes of homelessness and poverty. Paul, huge thanks to you and your team as always. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Chris Herring is assistant professor of sociology at UCLA. His forthcoming book is called Cruel Streets. It explores how San Francisco intensified punishment towards the unhoused amidst initiatives of criminal justice reform and shelter expansion. Chris, thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you on when your book comes out.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks to Chris Nooney for producing today's show. Thanks to David LaTulipe for engineering the show. And thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.